It is a landscape of lines. The beach stretches taut against the coastline, while the sky at the horizon's end arches back in perfect geometry. The peninsula is a fingerspit of sand 30 blocks long, culminating in the jetty. Great, hulking chunks of fractured granite that tumble out at right angles to meet the surf. Before they begin dredging the sand from the bay to fill in the beach, and before they built the breakwater to curb the ocean's torrent, the waves would hiss and spit in long arcs over the boardwalk, spraying against the bay windows of the houses that hunkered down against the wind and the sea and the sun. The rumble, roar, crash, and hiss of the waves as they grab at the sand and recede. This is my lullaby at night. The ocean, though, is too close in it in my dreams. We are only 4 houses down from this powerful force that at any moment can overtake us with its surges and excesses. The boardwalk, those old railroad ties that are gray and splintered, bumpy on our bicycle wheels, battered and beaten. They are nothing next to the power of the one big wave that I can see forming on the horizon. First a small bump, and then mounting, looming, larger and larger, until its spectacular crash on the sand. I am enthralled and terrified, two emotions that become as entangled as the seaweed that stretches out each morning on the sand. As a young child of 5, I play in the sand and water during the day. My nights are plagued with nightmares of my daytime memories of the sea's overwhelming power. When I am older, I dream only of body surfing, of catching the perfect wave. I spend every summer and autumn in the ocean, treading waters I scan the horizon, looking for the telltale sign of a mounting wave. It's all about timing. With just the right pull of my arms and kick of my feet, I can get just in front of the oncoming wave and catch it. Taking a deep breath, I will put my head down and ride the wave to the shore, the water pounding on my shoulders, the wave rumbling beneath my body. It's the most exhilarating feeling in the world. If I am not so lucky and my timing is not as good, I can fall beneath the crashing wave, with all of its unleashed power pushing me down to the bottom, crashing me into the sand, pinning me down, swirling in all of its fury. It takes me years to learn to relax into this power and to know that eventually I will come to the surface as the wave's energy is spent, where it will take me gently to the shore. When I'm finally tired of swimming, I will take my last wave all the way into the shore, walking up to the sand that is warm and has been waiting for me like a mother. Lying on my stomach, my elbows bent, my head propped up, I watch others swim. I can learn so much by watching them, marvel at their mastery. The ocean is a fickle parent. You must study it well, know its moods, when it is serene, when it is playful, when it is dangerous, when you can trust it, when you can't. We are taught, of course, from the time that we are little to never trust it. This is hard to do. It is hard not to trust something that you love, that is part of your every waking moment, your playground, your playmate, your friend. We are in the classroom, sitting quietly in our seats. The teachers are in the back of the room, their arms folded, waiting to swoop down on a misbehaving child. Today we have visitors. This is their annual visit. They stand in front, formal, polite. Their arms are thick with muscles that bulge from their short sleeves. They have brought their projector and a movie. We are going to get our annual talk about the dangers of the ocean and the bay and water in general. As the projector slowly ticks away and the movie images flash on the screen, they talk. They are politely grim. This is the scene where a motorboat is slowly trolling the bay back and forth. No children are swimming in the water. No adults sit on the sand. We watch as the scuba divers silently put on their masks and splash gently into the water. The lifeguards explain to us that the people in the motorboat and the scuba divers are trolling the bottom of the bay, searching for a drowned body. We stare in fascination and horror to see if they find one. The boat goes slowly up and down, mournfully. They never show us the body. As they talk on, the message slowly sinks in. We will be this body if we don't listen to them. It will be our parents waiting anxiously on the dock for this horrible bad news. This is what will happen, they tell us politely, if we swim without the supervision of an adult, or go too soon into the water after eating, or swim out too far after a water toy that has slipped away. As horrified as I am skeptical. I don't swim in the bay. It's boring. I always swim in the ocean because I want to practice the thrill of catching the waves. No one I know has water toys anyway. Those are for babies and for people who don't live here. And then the images shift to the ocean. I perk up. These pictures are different. People, adults and children, are standing next to the lifeguard station. The children are always crying. The adults' faces are contorted in pain. The camera pans to the back of their legs near their ankles. Everyone has this bloody puncture wound. It looks like a low-lying vampire has attacked them, and again, I'm horrified and fascinated. The lifeguards are administering first aid. These people, we are told, were attacked by stingrays. The stingrays love the warm water that comes from the PG&E plant in Seal Beach. They lie in the bottom of the sand, their beige color camouflaging their presence. When they are stepped on, their tails, with their medieval spikes, fling upward, sinking into the back of the flesh of the leg. "Shuffle your feet," the lifeguards admonish us. "Don't take big steps. Follow a bigger person into the ocean." The theory is, they explain, the bigger people will step on the stingray first, and there won't be any stingrays left when you step into the ocean. Well, I am safe, I reason with six-year-old logic. I always follow my older sister into the water. She never knows why, but I always let her go first. It wasn't until I was 13 that I actually had a friend who died in the ocean. Her catamaran, piloted by her father, capsized late one afternoon. Her father used the upside-down pontoons to huddle in to protect themselves, waiting to be rescued. But in the darkness of the night, in the vastness of the ocean, in the noise of the heavy motors of the Coast Guard cutters that plowed up and down through the waves, coming within yards of their boat, their rescuers could not see nor hear their shouts. They were found in the early hours of the morning when the sun's feeble rays sprayed out across the ocean. Cradled in her father's arms, my friend died of exposure. I remember her in the coffin, clothed in her favorite school dress, her blue lips, the sad sag of her mother's face. Tragedy, or the possibility of it, hovered over us. Beach children. You can go to any beach in the world and recognize the kids that have grown up by the water. They are unencumbered by clothing, things. Their hair is sun-bleached, their feet are bare. Their skin is dry. They squint in the sun. They are confident, unafraid. They scamper everywhere. They seem to know everything. Long ago, they stopped listening to the adults' rules and started listening to the ocean. There are four families close by with children my age and my sister's age. There's the McCallum sisters, Kate, Susie and Carol, and much later, Patricia. Their brown shingled house sits square on the boardwalk facing the ocean. Big picture windows in the first and second stories face out onto the waves, the sun, the sand. The McCallum girls' father is a doctor. They are husky with big personalities, just like their father. They're as strong as horses, my mother tells us, because their father feeds them only beef and milk. My mother is full of such epithets of wisdom. We go through the alley to get to their big backyard with the tall wooden gate that is latched. My sister and I are both a little timid. I guess our mother doesn't feed us enough beef and milk. But I marvel when there's a storm's alert and the surf's up. No lifeguards are on duty, and swimming is prohibited. My sister and I stand on the shore and watch the McCallum sisters plow through the waves, as if riding the waves in a storm were as simple as breathing. On the other side of the alley are the Harris twins, Billy and Bobby, and their older sister Marcia, who is closer to my sister in age. Marcia and my sister play games that don't include me. My sister is always willing to go along with whatever Marcia says. "We're going to play a new game," Marcia tells me. "We're going to test you to see how smart you are." I want to be smart. They do long division on the chalkboard, and when I beg them to teach me, Marcia whispers to my sister. My sister turns to me. "You have to wait until the third grade to learn this," she tells me with great severity. Now Marcia has a new game. I have become suspicious over time, but maybe I think they'll include me. I can see that she has used her doll dishes and has all of these little cut-up pieces of things, but she is too quick for me to get a good look. "You can't see what we're doing," says Marcia as she carefully places a cloth over my eyes. "We're going to put these in your mouth. We want to see if you can tell what each thing is. You can't touch anything." My sister is certain that I will cheat. "Close your eyes, even with the cloth over it," she admonishes. She tugs and tugs at the cloth to make certain that I really can't see anything. They're delighted with their game, I can tell. I don't really see the point. I am just hoping they don't feed me fried grasshoppers, which my mother did when her friends came over for a visit, wanting to share their country's delicacies with us. I am also hoping that there are no worms. If my sister doesn't trust me to cheat, I don't trust her to ever say no to anything that Marcia asks her to do. Three houses down on the boardwalk are the Poplars. They have so many children, 8, I think, that I can't even remember all of their names. The one that I do remember is Jerry. She becomes a famous female surfing champion. My sister is the local teacher, and I am her faithful assistant. My sister loves teaching. She plays school every day. We teach Jerry her letters, and we teach her how to read. We teach her how to skate and how to ride a bicycle. Watching my sister, I see how much fun this teaching is. We play it every day, trying to corral on the boys who are immune to school play. My mother is a teacher, too. She teaches anyone that she can to swim. We have learned from the time we were 2. She takes us every week to the Pacific Coast Club where there is a pool. My sister and I wear our matching bathing suits and swim caps. She stands in the shallow water, teaching us to float on our backs and put our face in the water and then to do the crawl stroke. Her crowning glory is teaching us to dive off the side of the pool in the deep end. I kneel down on my knees, shivering in the cold on the pool's edge, while she squats next to me, issuing instructions. My sister is on the other side. "Arms over your ears," she says. "Now stretch them out straight. Put your hands together. Now lean over. Bend your head down slowly and point to the water." She shows us each step. "Now, slowly, fall in." I want to gently fall in, but instead I rather plop, which ends up being a belly plop on the surface of the water. It stings my stomach, and I come up sputtering for air, frantically treading water. "That's better," she says, trying to encourage me. I don't tell her about my stinging stomach. "Let's try it again, one more time." She pulls me up out of the water while my sister clambers back over the edge. We live for the summertime. It's hard to wait all year long for the chance to have that unfettered freedom that summer provides. No rules, no classrooms, no responsibilities, or very few. We spend all day, every day at the ocean, and there is no end to what we can do. We can ride our bikes on the boardwalk and race through the quiet pairs of walkers who are taking a stroll. We can swim in the ocean when we get bored. We can play in the sand. We can go down to the jetty and watch the fishermen quietly baiting their hooks and casting out into the ocean. We can collect shells and sea urchins on the beach and run the full length of the beach playing tag with the waves. We can look for crabs that bury into the sand after the wave recedes. We can chase the seagulls in the turns and scatter them flying. We can lie in the sand after swimming in the cold water and slowly warm up. The sand and the sun are like a warm, slow blanket, soothing, relaxing, crooning us to sleep. Summertime isn't just for the children. It's for the adults, too. In the early afternoon, a group of mothers walk down the boardwalk in their black bathing suits, clutching their folding chairs, those wooden kind with the cloth covers and faded striped patterns. They have their sodas, their cigarettes, their beach towels, and their cards. They climb over the boardwalk railing and plunk down on the sand, close to the boardwalk's edge, where there's less wind. Bobby Poplar is fun. She's got a husky smoker's laugh. She's strong and opinionated, passionate. Ina Harris, Marcia's mother, is taller and slender and cooler in her personality. Ginger, the McCallum's mother, is small, redheaded, and quick. She darts around a lot, like a little bird. They sit there and they play for hours, day after day. Their skin is dark from the sun, their teeth are white, and they laugh a lot. They manage children's demands from their chairs, never leaving. They are serious about their cards and more serious about their fun. By the late afternoon, when the wind picks up and the waves are choppy and broken, they pack up their things and return home to their husbands and their kids. It's time to make daiquiris and dinner and settle in for the evening. My mother is not a card player. It is not like her to relax and have fun for hours and not worry about anything else. My mother is a swimmer. She goes with her friends every day to swim. They do this every summer for years. They put on their flowered bathing suits and walk down to the water's edge, right by the lifeguard stand, and plunge into the ocean. They swim straight out past the waves to the buoy, which bobs like a beacon about a mile out to sea. Once there, they swim around the buoy and head on back. It's midnight in July. The Grenyon are running, and we all, adults, children, infants, are out on the beach waiting for them to come. The moon hangs overripe with fullness, ready to drop from the sky. Moonlight streams out onto the waves. We are spread out the whole length of the beach, close to the water, clutching our buckets, waiting. There's a shout further down the way, and then suddenly the waves are thick with their silver bodies. Their scales shine like sequins, and in the moonlight, the grunion are luminescent. We laugh and scream and shout as they surf the waves to the ocean shore where the females will lay their eggs and the males will fertilize them. We wait until they have laid their eggs. We scamper in between the adults' legs and play tag and lose our parents in the darkness. Everywhere the grunion are flopping around, trying to catch a wave to return to the sea. We scoop up the slimy, shivering bodies into our waiting buckets. Our family doesn't collect the grunion. My father is an intellectual. He is not a sea person. We don't have a boat and we don't go deep sea fishing. My mother doesn't cook the grunion for us, she says, because they don't taste very good. But Ginger has brought lots of buckets. We run in between the adults' legs and we lose our parents and then look for them in the dark night.